Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly. This episode, we're diving into A Blade So Black by Elle McKinney, a complete reimagining of Lewis Carroll's classic Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is from 1865, and it's way older than I thought it was. In McKinney's book, Alice is a dreamwalker, a human being who travels between her hometown of Atlanta and Wonderland, a wildly different dream world. Dreamwalkers like Alice are trained to fight nightmares, human fears made flesh that take monstrous form and wreak general havoc. When her handler slash crush, Addison Hatta, gets sick, Alice teams up with dreamwalkers, Wonderlandians, and regular humans to find a cure. But shit hits the fan, as it does in YA novels we're seeing. And it all culminates in an enormous cliffhanger, so now we have to wait until September 2019 for book two, A Dream So Dark. What did you think of the book?
I thought the pacing felt off a little bit in the beginning, but after the first few chapters, things were such a whirlwind, and I really enjoyed the story, the characters, and the action. I love a good fight scene, so I was there for it. It was great.
I agree with you about the initial pacing and that the text finds its footing pretty quickly. It doesn't keep that going. I liked the book a lot. It wasn't, for me personally, like a keep me up till 4 a.m. I can't stop reading until I actually finish this sort of book. But I absolutely adore Alice as a character. I thought that was one of the strong suits of the novel. And Alice is so strong. She's honest. She's vulnerable. She's empathetic. And I think we could all do with a little bit more of those characteristics. Time to talk about world building in Through the Wardrobe, or maybe Through the Looking Glass is a more appropriate section title.
This book was all things Alice in Wonderland related, which I sometimes thought would give me hints as to how the story would play out. Like, I thought Chess was going to end up being about like the Black Knight. I was wrong.
I didn't even realize his name's
Like
I
the
didn't
treasure.
Get
okay,
that.
Yeah.
Or like chess. Like that's a part of the book too, right? Aren't there chess pieces?
I don't know.
Maybe not. Anyway.
Either way, I thought it was going to give me hints to what was going to happen. It didn't. There was just lots of surprises along the way. But I liked all the little like Alice in Wonderland Easter eggs.
So many of them. Like the Cheshire Cat clock, the name of the pub, her cat's names are Lewis and Carol. And also, I thought that the Addison Hatta, like his name was Hatta, I thought that was like a Demasiado, as in a little much, but.
Yeah, I did too.
But like he does eventually turn to the mad Hatter, quote unquote, right? But I mean, in any case, clearly a lot of thought went into the details and I thought that was really clever.
Agreed.
I agree with you when you said that knowing the original Alice in Wonderland didn't help you like game this plot and see where it was going to go, which I liked that I was surprised by many of the plot twists in this book because we're getting a reimagining of the Alice in Wonderland story. It's not just like changing Alice's skin color and plopping a black protagonist into a narrative that hasn't been like changed at all, which like I think a lot of these times these white narratives would be very hostile. Like our hostile environments, if you were to like change the character to a POC and just put it back in there and see how the plot unfolds, like that's not really, I don't know. I just thought like all the ways that McKinney changed the story and especially the emotional components, Alice's backstory, the like politics, like of racism and, you know, and like black violence or no, and like violence against black people, black children, that it's like this, she's melanating everything about it and it's so wonderful. And I loved how it was reimagined on a foundational level.
Agreed. I really actually thought in the beginning that we were just going to get Alice in Wonderland reimagined in modern times with a black character.
That's what I was expecting.
And maybe because I didn't really fully read the summary of the book, which is on me, but it was really good. And I was glad to have like a fully fleshed out different story than Alice in Wonderland. Because that also might have been kind of boring. Like, I don't love Alice in Wonderland, the story. We get to see Atlanta and Wonderland. We get to see more of Wonderland than actually, like, being around in Atlanta. But it was an interesting mix of, like, contemporary fantasy and like what we think of kind of more as like classic fantasy. And I thought that was a really interesting like thing to put those two together. We don't really get to see that very often where people are traveling literally between two realms. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I would say that that's like a common, we see that in specifically with like urban fantasy.
Right.
But I don't know if we've read that much. I mean, I guess City of like Bones. City of Ash, whatever the fuck it's called. City of Bones would be an example of that, right? Where they're technically moving between two worlds and they're very close. They're adjacent.
Right.
The magical world is adjacent to the real world and has like, but the real world, I should say non-magic world, doesn't know of its existence really.
Right.
What did you think about how Wonderland was described?
It was interesting to me. Like, it was a cool imagining of it, but it was also kind of like, I just kept thinking of like the cartoon movie, even though I've read the book before and seen other Alice in Wonderland movies. All I kept thinking of was the like old, I don't know when that movie came out, cartoon.
Like the original Disney cartoon.
Mm-hmm. And in this book, we get a much more like dark and violent picture of Wonderland than we do in that movie.
But also a much more like neon and textury representation.
Yeah, I didn't think about this before, but it did kind of feel like maybe like an acid trip.
Totally. Kind of. Oh my God. I kept thinking of Dr. Seuss landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Theodore Geisel is like a POS because of his racism and other bullshit. But
right.
like the remake of The Lorax,
mm-hmm.
the most recent one, how the like
it.
The trees are like fluffy,
mm-hmm.
and everything's so bright and neon, just like the textures and the smells and the like things working differently, the mending and the breaking, like
right.
their version of sunrise and sunset, I thought was like so cool and imaginative and interesting. I just really liked it.
Yeah, I think McKinney did a really good job of fleshing out Wonderland in a way we haven't seen it before, which was really cool because it's not what I expected to get from this novel at all. So, I mean, props to her. That's like a really good imagination she's got going on,
right.
to like reimagine a whole other world.
And I loved how it was almost true to the like lack of logic,
right.
of what the original has.
Yes.
How it's like, it's nonsense fiction,
mm-hmm.
and how the rolling hills are literally rolling. They
right.
literally move. I thought
right.
that was like, all these little details, I think, just made the world building incredible.
Or even like Maddie talking in rhymes and poems.
Yes.
Like you could kind of piece together maybe what she meant if you like stopped for a second and thought about it. But if you're trying to have a conversation with someone who's talking like that, it would be really frustrating. It was a lot.
And I think what we're getting the hint at in this book is that as the quote madness progresses in Addison, he's going to become more like this traditional Mad Hatter
right.
figure that we're used to seeing in the books and the remakes.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't know. We'll have a lot to say probably about ability and mental illness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Along the same lines, I loved the story of the Blind Thief's Forest, and this might sound like an idea that belongs on the Hydea's subreddit, but bear with me. Like, I thought it was interesting to suspend my anthropocentric perspective and imagine what it'd be like for other types of existence, like plants, to actually witness what happens in their surrounding. Like, is there plant consciousness, but just like not in a way that humans would think of consciousness in like a radically non-anthropocentric view? I don't know. It kind of like blew my own mind after reading the story of the Blind Thief's Forest. I was like, whoa. I went down this rabbit hole. Huh? I had to. Why are you shaking your head at
That's
me?
That's it. You're done. No more Alice in Wonderland puns. That story really creeped me out a lot. The idea of like the eyeballs being plants and like following people around. I was like, I don't have that thing, but you know, when you see like lots of little like holes and stuff, it like
yeah.
makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't like it.
Oh, that, yeah. I know what you're talking about. It doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah. I also recently learned that plants can get fevers when they're sick.
Really?
Yeah. So maybe plants do have some form of consciousness that we as humans just don't understand, since we try to like center everything around how we operate.
Exactly. I think that our human way of viewing existence is incredibly limited.
Yeah, it makes no sense. And if you think of plants like moving towards the sun, mm-hmm. like, of course, there's something going on there. We just don't understand it.
Right.
And we're just like not normally willing to say that. There were so many cats in this book, which I loved, of course. But also I liked it because it kept true to like the story, because I was thinking of like the Cheshire Cat and then Lewis and Carol, like you mentioned, those two cats. And then I wonderfully got a picture of Lainey, the pod cat, sitting on the book, like on top of it, like she's reading the book. It was real cute. I posted it on Twitter. She wanted to be involved in some way. Sweet potato pie is way better than pumpkin pie. I'm real sad about what you're about to say next.
My upbringing is so white that I've never had sweet potato pie ever in my life.
It's like a thing. Like Black people, a lot of us are like, no to pumpkin pie. Sweet potato pie is where it's at.
I'm not that into pumpkin pie. Like I don't.
No, it's disgusting because sweet potato pie is better.
Well, I'll have to try and make one and probably fuck it up.
I don't know how to make one. I've only ever had my grandma's. So I can't say for sure that all sweet potato pie is better. But I also really appreciated like these little tiny like snippets of Black culture within the books. Like her mom is wearing her headscarf because she's getting ready for bed. And like Alice is talking about like what she goes through to like keep her hair looking nice, and she's like upset about it getting wet, and she's like got her nice shoes on,
and on the train like, she's braiding her hair like yeah. knowing that she's gonna go fight. She's like, I need to put this in a protective style, and
exactly.
it's gonna be wet.
Yeah, so I really like those like little snippets of things that I was like, oh yeah, this is like, I like that. It's great.
Wands out.
Time to talk about all things magic. The magic is based a lot on the world building, and I think we might see more of it in the next book as we find out how Alice is slinging light beams out of swords, which was really cool. But I don't think we got things that were like super specifically like magically oriented, or maybe just everything was magic in Wonderland, so it didn't feel as like, I don't know, magical.
Or things like concepts like, I guess, self-confidence and belief in yourself
right.
are then conceived of as almost like a magical ability, like mm-hmm. muchness. It's given this sort of magical value
right.
in this other world.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really, well, it doesn't seem to come back into Atlanta with her when she comes back as much. I don't know. I think we'll get more in the next book.
I agree.
The light beam thing was really cool.
Yeah, we didn't really get like that info dump of how magic works.
No, not at all. And maybe we won't because it's illogical.
I think that the magic in the story is like very dream oriented. And maybe mm-hmm. that's just like a weird way of like a very simplistic thing that should be obvious. But that it's almost, I'm just imagining a different possibility of the way things can be rather than magicking it.
Right.
It's just different.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does. Like Alice can't like make things happen. She can kill nightmares, and that is her power. But she doesn't like have a wand. She's not like making, like she can't fix herself without Maddie's potions. Like mm-hmm. Addison can't fix himself without like these magical objects. So I guess maybe the magic is like more limited to like, right, like you said, your confidence, but also like magical objects, like actual things.
Or I guess there is magic that people can study,
mm-hmm.
but it's not clear like who can study it, like why Maddie and the Duchess know how to do it or
right.
can do it or how they learned it.
Yeah. Yeah. We get like no magical schooling, which is a little different for us.
Just sad because I like school. I have a complicated relationship with school, but I like learning. I'll say
like
it that way.
I like to learn. Yeah. So it was weird to like have a story that where we didn't get any magical learning at all.
Sad.
Yeah, a little sad.
Maybe next time.
For our Ravenclaw hearts.
The magic, I thought it was interesting that the magic takes a physical toll on Maddie, and we've seen this in other stories and other of the like other YA books that we've read for the podcast, where like Alina uses magic and it takes a toll on her body or it changes someone physically.
Right.
And I thought it was, I loved the Maddie being a poet who works with verses. And so that's like a, the equivalent of a witch working with spells.
Yeah.
I thought that was a cute little literary reimagining of what magic looks like.
And she's like concocting drinks. She's like making potions. Mm-hmm. I liked Maddie. She was like an interesting character to me. I also like that they call them verses, because like when we talk about raps, we talk about like when we talk about rap, you know, we talk about their verses as opposed to like lines like in poems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Just little snippets of blackness everywhere.
Odabeth using the eye reminded me of Galadriel when Frodo offers her the One Ring and they're in Lothlorien. Yeah. She's like, I'd be the most, she like lights up and glows and like talks differently.
Yeah, that scene in the movie, because I haven't read the books, always like scared me. When I was younger, I was like, oh, I don't like this, which I guess I'm not supposed to.
No, it's supposed to be scary.
Yeah. Except Odabeth doesn't seem like she's like taking advantage of whatever power the eye is giving her.
But I think that's almost the point, is that absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? Anytime anyone is given that power, there's the danger, even if they are a quote unquote good person.
Do you think she'll become bad in the next book? Like, do you think she'll use the power of the eye for nefarious reasons?
I don't know. I think that the reasons don't start out as nefarious.
Right. Oh, of course not.
But then they turn that way. It's like good people doing bad things, and that morphs into their identity.
Right.
If they just stick with it.
Yeah. Hmm. I'm interested to see what will happen with her in the next book, having all this power now. And she's a new queen, kind of, if her, she doesn't fix whatever is going on with her mom.
We'll have to wait and see.
September's not that far away. Wands away.
Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in our segment, Get Me Kylo Ren.
The imposter Black Knight and Addison as the Black Knight, I did not see that coming at all. I was so sure that it was going to turn out that Chess, because he had like those weird violet eyes. And I was like, what are violet? Like his purple eyes. I thought that was weird.
I want purple eyes. Purple's my favorite color.
Just get some of those contacts.
Oh, I should.
You wouldn't even have to wear your glasses anymore.
I thought Addison was just being a dick. When he was not believing Allison's like, no, it can't be the Black Knight. It can't be the real Black Knight. And I was like, oh. Then the realization that like he didn't want to admit that that was him. He was the real Black Knight, and this had to be an imposter.
But I'm also like, Addison, how about a little truthfulness here? Like, why are you lying to everyone about it?
Or why aren't you at least strategizing to try and figure out who it could be? Do you have a brother or a sister?
Oh, maybe
or
like a twin?
I don't know. Or is it the White Rabbit? When is the White Rabbit going to come in? I feel like that's too big of the Alice in Wonderland books for
I think there was
happen.
Like a rabbit that she saw somewhere. Or maybe it was just painting. Maybe he has like a... In the Alice in Wonderland, the Disney movie, the Mad Hatter has like a friend like that they do the little tea party with.
That's true.
I don't remember if that's in the books or not because it was a long time ago, but I don't know.
When Alice is advocating for Hada, she's standing up for healing and transformative justice. And I thought that was a really powerful part of the book. That it's, and what it made me think about is how it's actually really hard to come to terms with the awful things that people have done, which is why I don't really understand critiques of movements for prison abolition or transformative justice as like going soft on crime, in enormous scare quotes, to use that repulsive phrase. But I don't know. Did you have any feelings about that when Alice was advocating for him?
You know, I didn't really think about it, but it was one of those things where I felt bad for Addison because I was like, well, it was a long time ago and he said he was sorry. Like he obviously regretted the decision that he makes. So like, why is he still being punished?
And he's been practicing.
Right.
Like, I don't know, like trying to make things better, I guess.
Yeah. So I really was like, yeah, you should not continue to be punished if you feel remorse for what you did and have attempted to make an actual change. So, yeah. Restorative justice. Like, why not?
The imposter Black Knight is trying to separate Alice from her mentor, aka Hada, by sowing seeds of doubt, which then says to me that this Black Knight, imposter Black Knight, knows Hada really well somehow, because it's like knows how he's gonna think.
Right.
But this struck me as like a typical villain trick that we see in YA a lot of the time. And it reminded me of what Slytherin's locket says to Ron in Harry Potter.
Right.
It's trying to break the unity of the like hero team.
Right. Which in the end, for in this story, in A Blade So Black, brings them closer together. Because then that's after, is that when like Addison and Alice like have their little like makeout sesh?
Yeah, I think so.
Like after that happens. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know. Step up your game, villains. It doesn't work.
We've been there, done that.
Been there, done that.
I want to ask you a question about, what do you think about the villains and the evil in this book, and like with most other books ever, being associated with the color black? Because we have the Black Knight, the Vorpal Blade, which is a blade so black, hence where the title comes from, the Black Mark that poisons Addison, the Queen of Lunderland becoming the Black Queen when she goes bad, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm not a fan. Actually, I really hate it. I don't like, and it's hard because I know that it's like very situated in like race, but I don't like that we're like white is good, black is bad all the time in every YA book we read.
On a symbolic and literary level, and also mm-hmm. on the level of like world building and magic and character development.
Right.
But at the same time, this is such a celebration of blackness.
Right. So I was a little surprised that they, like even the Black Knight, I was like, why are they calling him the Black Knight and Addison some white dude? Like, why can't he have another name? Why can't we use other colors? You know? Why does it have to be black and white?
Yeah, the Black Knight. Addison was the original Black Knight, and he's white AF.
Yeah.
So, like,
he's
what?
Got green hair. That is a white people
it
thing.
It is a very white thing to, like, dye your hair neon. Majoritarily, I would say.
Yeah.
Ask me how I know.
Yeah. How do you know? Yeah, I'm not, like, really appreciative of this. I've read some books where they associate, that's, what was I reading? A book where it was like based in Greek mythology and white is the color of mourning and black is the color of like, it is like a repels negativity and that sort of thing. Kind of like we see in, some pagan religions where black is used as a color to like keep bad things away from you. And I really appreciated that in those books because then it made black as not like a bad color.
Mm-hmm.
I say that saying that there were a shit ton of white people in those books, though.
Yeah. Well, I've been watching Queen Sugar and there's a funeral scene and the close family of the person who died is all wearing bright white.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know if that's like a mourning tradition in black culture in the United States. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, actually. I don't know.
Not like asking you as Native
American. No,
informant.
I know.
Just
yeah,
like
yeah.
asking in general.
Yeah. But I also don't know. But also there's like a lot of other colors out there. Why not just use something else?
Yeah, exactly.
Like red. Why can't red be the bad color? It's one of my favorites, but still.
It's more symbolic and like a blood. I don't know. It makes more actual, tangible, physical sense.
Right. Because I think
versus
like
the other
blood.
Part is just kind of like. It's just racist.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels racist.
It feels racist, I should say. Yes.
No, I think it, I mean, I'm going to say maybe is as well.
Well, maybe it's like a product of.
Right. Yeah.
Racist narratives traditionally. I don't know.
I wonder in like African traditions and religions, if white and black hold those same like symbolic natures, like is white good and black bad still? I don't know.
I think if we take it out of the paradigm of race, it could even. Just into like the physics,
mm-hmm.
black or darkness would be more unknown. The
right.
unknown, right? Being mm-hmm. afraid of the dark is more being afraid of the unknown versus right. if something's in the sun and the light, you can see what it is and it's less threatening,
right?
I guess.
So yeah, that's true.
I think you could take it out of a racial paradigm too.
Right.
I don't mean to just box it into there.
No, but it's hard to remove it from that, in my personal opinion and for me.
We've got a Nikolai Sitch on our hands. The chess turned into a monster underling trapped in another body and fighting to stay himself.
Yeah. I don't really know what's going on with that. I know it's like cliffhanger, wait till the next book, yada, yada, yada. But
because he attacks Maddie at the end, right?
Yeah.
Because of, I assume he is in some sort of communication with the Black Queen.
Yeah, I think it's the Black Queen for sure. I think he even calls the voice he hears her, I think. So... yeah, I'm going to guess it's the Black Queen.
A Blade So Black really made me think that, be drawn to this common thread that we see in the YA books that we've been reading about the way a character handles grief is a good predictor of whether they'll be a villain or a hero. So if they process it and deal with it and let it happen to them and move through it, and then I guess choose love at the end of the day, that's like the hero's journey, versus the villain is the person who doesn't process it or lets it consume them or tries to repress it.
Right.
And the grief turned the High Queen in this narrative, grief turned the High Queen into the Black Queen. And I don't know. I just had that observation.
Yeah, I didn't really think about how we see that all the time in YA.
Like the Darkling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Grief, not belonging, not being understood.
And I think a lot of it, we don't see it with the Black Queen because we don't get really a lot of her backstory. Both characters, like the Darkling and other characters we've seen, a lot of that stems back to like the way that they were raised, which is pretty interesting to think about how the way you handle grief being associated with the way your parents taught you to handle grief, or, you know, the people, the adults in your life taught you to handle those things,
mm-hmm.
or didn't.
Which seems to be Alice's case in this book, mm-hmm. that she said that she was alone when she's talking about how her mother was processing her father's death.
Right. Which would be so difficult. I can't even imagine being like a 16-year-old trying to deal with your parent dying and then your other parent kind of just
having to take care of your other parent.
Right. Yeah. And I guess a grandparent as well.
Right. And that's not to say that I don't think we should embrace an ethics of care.
Right.
But that it should be reciprocal or like not one directional.
Right. Right. Well, and I think it's hard too, because I don't think that young people should be having to care for their parents.
Seconded. But at the same time, like sometimes you have no other choice.
Right. Right. And that's not to say that losing your husband wouldn't also be, or partner, wouldn't be a very difficult thing to go through. I can't imagine that either.
No.
It'd be awful. I have my cat, so I guess I'd be okay.
Eventually.
Eventually. It'll all be fine.
I've been listening, I've recently come across the author Liz Gilbert's interviews and posts about grief, because her partner died about a year ago from cancer. And her posts and her interviews just really illustrate how profoundly complex this experience is. I think when she writes and talks about it, it makes it almost like you can't feel it, obviously. Like, I don't know, I haven't experienced grief this profound. So I find that reading about it and listening about it, I'm like very like curious about it. Maybe that's a weird word to use, but I really liked her interviews and posts about grief. Her Instagram has a lot of really good posts about it.
I have to check that out.
Yeah. Well, Jesse, just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. I'm going to start with a softball about race and then let Jesse take the lead. The jokes about white people not seasoning their food always make me laugh. I think they're so funny. It is so fucking true.
They get me every time. I saw the funniest meme that I'm going to have to find so that I can post it with this about, and it was like this couple, the guy was Black, the girl was white, and they both looked very upset. And apparently they had gone to the Black family for Christmas and they put like seasoning in the white girl's stocking, like to be like, and like, I laughed out loud. I was just like, oh, this got me good. But also it's true.
And the like, how many places can you name joke? Yeah. I stopped and I was like, thinking about it and like listing them in my head, like, oh shit, I hope I can. And I was realizing, I was like, mainly Italian / white culture related spices. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah. You gotta get some more ethnically diverse cookbooks.
For real. And we do, we have them. It's actually like this running conversation in my home right now. Like my partner and I will make we've been making more Indian food mm-hmm. recently, and my partner and I will like ask whether this recipe has like a quote unquote white person amount of seasoning and whether we should add more.
But how do you know?
The answer is always yes. I don't know, you just try it.
Okay. Okay. But it's still your taste palette. Like, it's going to be a white person amount of seasoning because it's made for you.
And by me.
And by you. Made for and by you.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I don't know. Trying to... It's just funny that that's like a conversation happening in my outside life right now. And I saw these jokes in this book. I was like, so true. Yeah. So true.
The pumpkin spice latte thing. I say that as a Black person who loves a pumpkin spice latte. Much like Alice. But yeah, that one got me good. I wish pumpkin spice lattes were still around. All right, now we're going to talk about some more, like, I guess, difficult things with Reese.
We're going to get into it.
A little more heavy. So I really appreciated how this book showed and allowed for the vulnerability of Black women. I think a lot of times we, in novels and media and everywhere, we get these depictions of the strong Black woman. And I liked how we saw Alice's mom having difficulty dealing with the death of her husband. Alice is dealing with the death of her dad and, like, trying to save the world. I really appreciated seeing a book where the Black women didn't have to be strong for everyone else all the time. It was great.
Absolutely. And that just that there's, you know, ample space in this narrative for Black women to be all the things that they actually are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was really good. And I guess this is something that we get when we have authors who are from that background writing the stories, when we get own voices stories that we don't always get when someone else is writing the books for us. And then even though she's a badass superhero fighting monsters in another land, Alice is unable to escape the violence done to Black bodies, like the girl in the story who died from a police officer. She was shot by a police officer, Brionne, or the fear that the violence causes her mother, which I thought was a really big issue to deal with in the book, that even as you're diving into this fantasy novel, you can't escape the real world and the real world repercussions of living as a Black person.
Yes, the narrative weaves this together really seamlessly and really, really masterfully. And it just goes to show that the systemic nature of oppression, right? That even you can do everything right and it doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah, like, exactly.
You're still going to experience violence because of who you are and how you exist in the world, right, and how you've been racialized.
Yeah.
In this particular case.
I did appreciate that, like, within Wonderland and when Alice is interacting with the twins and with the people in Wonderland, they don't really seem to have these, like, racial divides. And I'm guessing because, like, we see people in Wonderland of all different skin colors and hair colors and, like, just all kinds of different creatures. We don't really get those, like, racial divides between, like, Addison, Maddie, the Duchess, the Princess. Like, all of them are just, and even some of the queens were differently colored, mm-hmm, and their kids were differently colored than them. I really appreciated that.
Absolutely. There's one point in the novel where I was particularly struck by the different parenting approaches along racial lines, and Alice is deciding to try one of these excuses that Courtney uses on her mother, the "I accidentally turned my phone on airplane mode" excuse. And this is a quote from Alice. "Court used that line on her mom once, and Alice decided to steal it for just this occasion. But Courtney's mom was super suburban white, and Alice's mom probably had 'try me' tattooed across her knuckles in a previous life." It's on page 134. And it's funny, but at the same time, this is just like such a great example of how a joke is rooted in something really scary and very important, which is that white people don't have to worry as much about experiencing racism or violence like people of color do. And that reflects on how you raise your children.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. And coming from a home with one Black parent who is my dad and a white parent who is my mom, their parenting styles were very different, which I do have to say, probably not the best way to raise your kids, because, like, you probably should decide those things before you have them, but they didn't. So that's what I'm left with. But yeah, their parenting styles were very different, where my mom was like Courtney's mom and my dad was like Alice's mom, but, like, to the nth degree. So, and I think some of that stems from Alice's mom feeling like no matter what they do, like, things are going to happen to them, even if they're doing the right thing all the time. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, the excuses will get you out of a lot with the white parent,
they
in
will.
My experience.
Mm-hmm. And mine too.
Get away with a lot more stuff with that. Always go to that parent. with the problems. I really appreciated Court admitting that she didn't understand racism. We don't get a lot of those, like when in The Hate U Give, what's the main character's name?
Star.
Yeah, Star has that friend who is being racist, and she like thinks she can understand what's going on, and she's white. But I really appreciated a different side of that story where we get a friend who's like, yeah, I can never understand that, but I'm here for you if you need anything. If you want to talk about it, let's talk about it. If you don't, don't. I was like, man, that's some allyship. I really appreciated that a lot.
It's definitely like this microcosm, like a fictional retelling of the complex dynamics of in cross-racial friendships that are inevitable. And of course, the burdens fall usually on like non-white people, like emotional work, catering to white comfort or white fragility, et cetera. And Rachel Ricketts, the writer and social justice activist, has a recent article called The Year I Gave Up White Comfort. And she addresses these issues and talks about like how white friends just kind of leave when you stop catering to their white fragility.
Yeah, I actually also just read that article. I think I tweeted it on the JK It's Magic Twitter, but it was a great article and I enjoyed it a lot. And I was like, oh, it's really good to have like white friends who will be there for you and can talk to you about those things, but also realize when you don't want to talk about that and you don't want to have to do that emotional labor. Kelly is one of those people, and it's something I really appreciate in you, calling you out on the podcast.
Thanks.
You're welcome. But when I read it, I was like, oh, I don't need to forward this to Kelly because she's doing these things already. And I really appreciate having you as a friend.
And I read it. I was reading the same thing. It's funny that we were reading the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, we do that all the time for the podcast, but we also do it with articles.
Yeah. And it's great.
And I think as a white person, being a friend to people of color, like just I think Robin DiAngelo talks about this in her book, White Fragility, mm-hmm. about the more you deal with this and the more work you do, the less fragile as a white person you become, mm-hmm. and you can hold space for more things. You don't get defensive and you don't, or maybe defensiveness does come up, but you recognize it and you like fucking cut that shit out,
right.
And you are doing the work all the time. It's a verb, right? It's not a thing you are. It's a thing that you're doing constantly.
Yeah. I really appreciated the like black people liking quote unquote white things and getting made fun of for it, something you experience a lot as like a black nerd. We call ourselves blurreds.
I didn't know that.
Now you learn something new. But we get made fun of a lot for that stuff. Even my boss at work talks about, because he's like really into Star Trek and like sci-fi stuff. And myself as a black person who loves to read and loves Star Trek and fantasy and sci-fi, like you get called an Oreo or like other names, and it's not really appreciated. And I don't like these markers of like things are white or therefore black people, you know. Well, okay, never mind, I take that back about the black people. I don't appreciate things being just for white people.
Because we either everything is already for us or we make things that aren't for us.
Yeah,
for us.
But like sci-fi and fantasy and like pumpkin spice lattes, those aren't things that should just be for white people. But I liked the acknowledgement that that happens in real life.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and like coming from the opposite experience, belonging is something like racially in those spaces that me as a white person, I've never had to think about.
Right.
It just is assumed.
Even I think we see it sometimes with people being like, well, I'm playing a character, so it's okay for me to dress in blackface. And it's like, nope, that is never okay.
Nope, that's never.
Never okay.
No.
I'm just going to put that out there. Ahun, I'm gonna guess that's how it's pronounced, a place filled with the worst nightmares based on the real world lived experiences of black people. That was a really, I want to say, like cool thing to add to the story. Like Wonderland doesn't even escape racism in any way, shape or form, and like the worst nightmares come from that, and they get worse when there's like a police shooting that happens and someone dies in that community because of white violence. I really liked that part of the book.
I thought it was really helpful, maybe is the right word, mm-hmm. to make it a physical geographical place in the dream world, because this dream world is attached to what humans dream about / have nightmares about, mm-hmm. and it makes sense then that geographically and then also in the flora and fauna that inhabit that place and come out of that place, they are literally incarnating these fears that a big and important sector of the population has.
Right. Right. And it was interesting too, because it's like so physical, like not just like, I think that sometimes when people think about the fears that Black people have on a day-to-day basis, they feel imagined. And so to make them a physical thing that is like coming after you and that Alice has to kill as a Black person experiencing these experiences, I thought that was an interesting way to take the violence that we experience on a day-to-day basis. It was really good.
And that things that we would, maybe I'm speaking as a white person, maybe, mm-hmm. that we would say aren't connected to reality, like dreams and nightmares,
right.
actually very much are. Like your dream world is absolutely connected to your experiences that you have in the physical material world.
Right. And like when you think about nightmares or something, like sleep is supposed to be the time that you can rest and like recharge. And so Black people having these nightmares, physical and like in a dream sleep state, that are keeping them awake and like causing them pain in their sleep, the time that you shouldn't have any of those issues. I just thought that was a like great way to go with that. I really liked it. Something the book touches on a bit, I wouldn't say it was like a big part of the book, but it spoke to me, is the things Black women in particular put themselves and their hair through, not to mention the money spent to adhere to white beauty standards. Alice says beauty is pain, and I think that is particularly true for POCs who are like trying to adhere to the standards that white people set up for them or sometimes force them into.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like real shitty. I was glad it was included in the book, but reading it, I was like, oh yeah, I forgot that was like, because I've just been like, nah, I'm not doing that. I'm just gonna like live with my curly hair, and it's a little easier for me, I think, because I'm mixed and I benefit from light skin privilege and a different kind of curly hair. But I really enjoyed that part of the book.
Absolutely. And then it just brings up for me that when I've heard white women say this,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, I think I've said this, that like, and then comparatively, we have no fucking clue. We're not trying to fit beauty standards that like are, you know, forced on us by an oppressor.
Right.
You know, like high heels and waxing is one thing, but the comb, oh my god, the like
such a good description of the comb in the story. I was like, wow, you got this.
And the like skin lightening creams, mm-hmm. and all this stuff versus like white people are trying to go get spray tans to be darker. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
you get to go get like painted versus the like
literally like bleaching your skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we mentioned the documentary Good Hair in a different episode. It's with Chris Rock, but he really delves into like the Black hair industry. And like a chemist was literally like, you should not put relaxers anywhere near your hair. Like he did not believe that it was possible that people were putting it anywhere near their bodies because it literally melts a Coke can. Like it's terrible. But we do that so that we can have straight hair because that's like what the beauty industry says is beautiful because it's white. So, I don't know. It's frustrating. I don't want to tell people what to do. Maybe you just like your hair straight and that's also fine, but it's also hard and it sucks.
It's inevitably tied up in this sort of like what this industry wants their consumers to do.
Yeah, and it's expensive. It's so fucking expensive. It's ridiculous. I just, yeah, I hate it. I hate it all. I hate everything. So thinking about Alice's dad dying young of heart failure and how trauma causes Black people and people in general to die younger, I've been reading The Deepest Well by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, and she talks about, I think it's their ACE scores, and so we'll link to that. There's a great NPR article about it, but how when you like have these certain things that have happened in your life, like you are the victim of violence, alcohol abuse, substance abuse, emotional abuse, like all these things cause you to have medical issues that shouldn't be happening for someone in your age group, like heart failure. And I thought of Alice's dad in this instance because he's living his life as a Black man in Atlanta, which is a place that is slowly becoming more and more gentrified. More white people are moving in because it's cheaper to live there. And I wonder if that, I thought of that when I thought of this, her dad dying so young of heart failure of all things.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this called elsewhere called racial battle fatigue.
Yeah. And it makes sense. It's a hard thing to be thinking about every day and, you know, all the time.
And it's an important also to that we have this language to link the experience of like social of in social situations, like how we're socialized and how like race is a social construct. And,
right.
But that actually does have material physiological effects, like absolutely does.
Yeah.
Long term, like acute as in like just violence
right.
against POC.
Mm-hmm.
And then but also on a chronic level.
Right. I think that you're like the possibility of you having like chronic diseases, autoimmune diseases is much higher from living with those things day in and day out.
Stressors.
And yeah.
I think that the medical community doesn't understand how stress
no.
affects people and certain people and their neutral, how they base that off of is a white neutral.
Yeah.
And the experience of people of color in medicine just in general is like abhorrent a lot of the time. And yeah, there's these studies that doctors actually think that people of color don't feel as much pain.
Yeah. Yeah. They are often not given as much pain medication
yes.
as like a white counterpart would for the same situation or like turned away altogether.
Mm-hmm. So like experiencing things because of race, experiencing physiological and damage and on a chronic level because of racism. And then when you go to get help, the system is still racist.
Right.
So
yeah.
like the help you're getting is not actually helping you that much.
No.
Or your odds for actually getting help are lower.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck.
I know. I would like to point out that Dr. Harris is a Black woman, so I really appreciate it coming at this idea of trauma and how trauma in your childhood and life can affect you. It's not through the lens of race, like she's not going that route, but I appreciated it coming from a Black woman who can understand like how these things happen to us and our people.
You ready to move on to class?
Let's talk about class. I would say that we don't get these like huge class distinctions that we have gotten in other books. But I liked the distinction between like Alice and Court, and they're obviously from different socioeconomic classes. When Alice goes to Court's house, it's like a mansion. They have a water thing in their driveway, a fountain. That's what it's called, a fountain, like multicolored and a roundabout. And I'm just like, wow. And Alice is just like living in like what I would say is a normal home.
Mm-hmm.
It was just interesting to see that like dynamic between the two of them.
And also that class and race are inevitably intertwined and everywhere, but particularly in the South, right? I was
yeah.
imagining it. Maybe it was even described as like a plantation style home. Like it
oh,
looked
it
like
have,
a,
yeah,
you know,
like
with the
pillar,
like the columns. Mm-hmm. And then you're just thinking of like, you know, slave owner mansion.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love those style of homes, but they're also terrible.
Mm-hmm. They have a dark history. Not oh. dark. Bad.
Oh, shit. It's ingrained
fucking
within
A.
us. And then we see, like, this class distinction between Odabeth and Xylon. That's how I would pronounce it. Xylon?
Xylon?
Yeah.
Xylon?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I don't know.
Xylophone?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's XY.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, anyways, I was, like, here for them, like, coming together and, like, but I was also, like, there is like a power dynamic going on there.
And it gets really complicated when one person is literally serving the other.
Yeah.
They're going to have a lot of like work to do in couples counseling.
I hope we see some of that in future books. I'm guessing that Odabeth will start like to turn kind of bad and evil. And Xylon's going to have to like deal with that, like figure that out as someone she is like, quote unquote, beneath class wise, and also who is like her kind of girlfriend, maybe. I don't know.
This kind of segues into the next point I want to make, that you mentioned all of the rulers in Wonderland are women.
Yes.
And to me, it's curiouser and curiouser. Ha, ha. I did it again. I did it again. Why the dream world with vastly different logic and ways of working falls back on the goddamn monarchy as a system of government. What the fuck, Wonderlandians?
Yeah, I didn't think about that at all. That is strange.
It's interesting how this especially the paradigm of like medieval, mm-hmm. the medieval and feudal way of organizing things, knights, right. like lords, kings, queens, etc. It's class based and like, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I don't know. I just think I'm just reminded time and time again how it really does have this stranglehold over fantasy as a genre.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because even they have like the knights, like Xylon is a knight, but we have a woman in charge of protecting the queen and then the, I guess, princess. She's the crown queen.
Acting queen, interim queen.
Interim queen, yeah. The queen daughter. it's a strange thing. They've just like decided to like switch it gender wise and be like, instead of men in charge, we're gonna have women in charge, but the same exact system. Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Thank you. Next.
Thank you.
Next world, next system.
On gender, Alice and Court have an actual nice, non-catty female relationship, and we always seem to have in books like these relationships where the two, like the girl is a girl who has no friends that are girls, and I'm like, what? Like, I'm sure it's a thing, but also why? And I know Court gets upset with Alice, which I thought was a bit ridiculous since Alice is literally saving the world, but they're teenagers and allowed to be upset about dumb things. And I was just like, huh, all right, you guys are like, okay, Court apologizes, Alice apologizes.
They cry, they hug.
Yeah, and then they're like, we're back. And Court's like, let me help you save the world. I appreciated it.
You have a Jesse with another generous reaction that I wasn't really expecting. Courtney pissed me the fuck off. I had a completely different reaction. I wanted to sit her down for a lecture while she was pulling that bullshit. Her reaction during the whole friend fight situation is an incredibly privileged one, particularly along race and class lines. How fucking nice that Courtney's biggest issue is her friend ghosting her on her birthday, which she like throws, like probably spends thousands and thousands of dollars of her parents' money on. But meanwhile, Alice moves through the world two worlds, worried about dying and worried about being murdered because of how she exists. And I was like, get the fuck over yourself, Courtney. I am like so mad at you. Being a teenager is not an excuse. You need to be called out. As a white woman, the situation really made me want to like get my people and just like shake her until she understood. And I know she's like a fictional teenager, but I'm livid just talking about it. And this made me so fucking mad.
I respect that. I was like frustrated with Courtney, obviously, because I'm like, dude, like she literally texted you and said she almost died. But then they're like, fine afterwards. And I was like, all right.
And almost like seeing Alice be like being okay with Courtney making this like a false equivalency thing.
Right. Like,
no. Like that is not okay. And I get that like because of probably the racial dynamics in a friendship that maybe Alice didn't feel comfortable calling out Courtney and being like, what the fuck is actually wrong with you? If you want to be my friend, stop being so shitty.
Yeah. And after Chess found out about it, he should have been more on Alice's side and like defended her. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, he's kind
of
shitty.
I'm just like, no, this was the climax of the book for me.
Oh my God.
Like, no, not really. But I have so many feelings.
Yeah. But then we do see like a little bit of cattiness between Alice and Duchess, like not really realized cattiness, but Alice is obviously jealous of the relationship that Duchess has with Addison. And I don't know where that's going to go because it was like so like such a simmering like upsetness about it. But I was like, yeah, where is this going to go? What did go on between Duchess and Addison? I'd be a little pissed too. But they're like haven't like had the define the relationship talk. So like that's fine, I guess. Mm-hmm. Whatever. I don't really like Duchess that much now.
I loved how this book, after just getting all angry and worked up, that I loved how this book shows anger as a productive, valid, and important emotion. I mean, and of course, racialization comes into play with the profoundly upsetting and damaging angry black woman stereotype that white people use to invalidate the anger of women of color. But I like this anger was just given such ample space and And I appreciated that in the narrative.
Especially because we see a lot of Alice's mom getting angry. She gets angry a lot at Alice because, one, Alice is being the shittiest kid ever. Like, why can't you just figure out how to text your mom back? Like, or give the phone to... What? Like, why did you only just now think of giving the phone to Maddie? Why didn't you tell your mom you had a job at this pub that is, like, a made-up place? I know you're going to Wonderland, but at least you could say, I was at work. Like, there were a lot of things she could have thought of to say or do that would have helped this and not made her mom so mad. But I understand her mom's anger. She's scared for her child's life. Of course she's upset. She's worried. Think about your parents, people. Well, sometimes. Not always.
Not too much.
Not too much. They're kind of shitty sometimes, too. Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own. Something why I never... does when there's a big age difference between love interests is actually acknowledge that.
Totally.
I'm thinking like Edward and Bella, even though like I know I liked that book in high school and now I'm like, oh, it's trash, but like
totally
they don't really deal with the fact that people would think it was weird. And so I was really appreciative that Alice was like, Addison is super old and that's weird.
And then I kind of liked Courtney's things like, buddy looks young so it's fine, which is of course problematic, but I thought it was funny.
Yeah Like even when I think of like like Tamlin and Feyre, like he's super fucking old and they're just like, it's fine.
Alina and the Darkling, which is like a ship I was fine with, and I'm like worried about myself because of that. Anyway, that's for my therapist and I to talk about.
You should talk to them about that.
And then like Aelin and Rowan.
Like, all of them have this huge age difference, and they're just going to pretend it doesn't exist. But I'm like, no, this is super fucking weird. They've been alive for, like, 1,000 years, and you're, like, 16.
But I get that yeah. I guess it's true. I think age is one of those taboos that is super, super complicated.
Yeah, it is, of course. And often the books, like, kind of try and fix that by making them wait till they're 18 to actually have sex, or, like... there's an age difference, but one of them is technically an adult, so like it's fine.
Well, there's like a transformation species wise.
Exactly. But I'm also like, whatever, like just do the damn thing or like don't do it at all, you know? And at least acknowledge it. Like if it were me, like I really love the idea of dating Chris Pine, but like he's a lot older than me. And I think about that. He's like 40, but still.
Chris Pine. Anyway,
I think I meant Chris Evans. Actually, it was one of the Chris's.
Chris Evans.
I mean Chris Evans.
You mean Captain America?
Yeah, I mean Captain America.
Okay, I was gonna be like, you mean Captain Kirk? Because I don't think you do.
I also like him, but I prefer Chris Evans because he's like a feminist and like stands up for people and loves animals. He seems cool.
I really admire Alice's capacity to hold space, particularly for Hada. And we see this on page 257 and then later on page 327 where she's just holding him and just like witnessing his experience, not filling it with words, not trying to tell him how to feel or talk him out of his feelings that he's currently feeling. Just like lets them happen, but is there also like present. It was so powerful and it's such an incredible gift to give someone else.
I really appreciated that. Sometimes you just want someone to like hold you and love you, but like not say anything. Like you don't need anything from them, you just need to be upset for a little bit. And I really appreciated that Alice is like, she's like real supportive.
Can
and
we
great
be friends?
Yeah. She's too young to be my friend. She's like 16. Actually, I guess she's almost 18. I bet they'll wait till she's 18 so that her and Addison can hook up.
I don't know if that makes it any
I don't know. I actually don't care really, but I'm also like just have a talk about it. They have a lot of lived experience you don't have.
Another thing I really loved is that the novel doesn't make it a thing when Alice says she thinks Zelon is a hottie on page 204. It's just not a thing. So can't we just be done with homophobia and biphobia already? I'm like Hannah Gadsby and Nanette. I'm tired. I identify as tired.
Yeah, I wrote it down. I was like, is Alice bisexual? I don't know. They never come back to it, but I'm like, all right, that's fine. Like, she thinks cool. She's hot. That's cool. And we get gay characters because we have Odabeth and Zylon. I don't know what'll happen between the two of them, but like, yeah. And no one makes a big deal about it. They're just like, that was romantic.
Just tired.
then you had to appreciate this book because they were like,
yes,
well,
totally.
We're not going to make a thing of it. It just is what it is.
Exactly. And that's good.
Sexy times.
Makeout scene?
Yeah, it was fine.
We're reading ACOTAR next, so.
I'm so excited. That was like a sigh of relief.
A sigh of relief.
Of release, if you will. I knew that was going to be what you said.
Watch your back. Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else we feel like talking about in Kill Your Darlings.
So the only thing I really have to say is that I really wish this book had been written from first person POV. We get a ton of inner thoughts from Alice through the narrator, and I think the book could have benefited from first person, especially because so much of the exposition sounds like Alice's voice. I thought that was really weird to put it in third person, especially because the narrator doesn't seem to be omniscient. Like, the narrator doesn't know what's going on with anyone else. I think I don't like third person limited.
Lit Crit would call this a third person narrative with an internal focalization in the protagonist. Like, so, I mean, it's just a
I don't think of, I like it.
You don't have to like it. I appreciated how the voice, that AAVE is a fundamental part of Alice's voice. So then I agree with you. A lot of the times this, when people use, authors use third person with internal focalization in a specific character, you won't get that actual style of like voice from talking. But maybe that's because it's like a white narrator.
That's true. Maybe this is a black narrator. And so I should like come to terms with that. But it just felt weird. I think because of like the narrator would like use slang terms and like say, like the sentence structure sometimes was different, and I was just like thrown off by it being with the narrator and not within Alice's speech or in Allison's head. Yeah, Allison, that is her name. That it like threw me off for kind of a while, and it took me a long time to get into it, and then sometimes it would come up again and I'd be like, wait, but Alice isn't the narrator.
I think that's because we're really conditioned to think that the narrative voice is a quote-unquote neutral, as in like white, non-racialized voice.
Yeah, you're right.
And then this is like an example of what a black narrator could actually sound like in a book.
Now I'm struggling with this a little bit, with like internally how I feel about this.
You can be conflicted. It's fine. I am
conflicted.
I hadn't thought about this before until we were talking about it just now.
Which is funny because it's not like the first, but well, actually, this is not the first book I've read where this has happened. And I don't think I was upset with it last time. All right, I'll deal with that on my own. I don't know how I feel about it. Read The Wedding Date by author's name I can't remember. I think they do that in there. It's a adult romance, but it's great. Black author. Loved it. That's all I got.
Random white characters in the book were actually described as white.
Like, everyone's race was described.
Yes.
Everyone's. There was a person who had, like, a headscarf on. Like, what is it called?
Hijab?
Yeah. And they like mentioned that. And when she went to go get water, like drinks for everyone, there were like waters on the tray as well as alcohol, because I'm guessing maybe she doesn't drink alcohol and maybe people with her didn't for religious reasons. Oh, I loved it. I was so happy.
So happy. And like, asterisk, I have to, feminist killjoy, that like, it really stood out to me having a person being described as a white guy. Like, a random character sitting in a bar, right? Described as a white guy. I'm like, no, that's how it should always be.
Right.
But it never is.
No, we just default to a guy. And it's like,
I assume
that they're white.
I personally would default that guy is white.
I would too. Well, maybe not in Atlanta, but like in
Well, but I would, right? Because I've grown up and been in super segregated white spaces.
Yeah. And for me, I probably wouldn't, having been to Atlanta a few times, but I get why that would happen. Or if you forget that this book takes place in black spaces. I loved it. I was so happy.
So good.
Recommend if you like. Action-packed, page-turning adventures.
/ Lewis Carroll's original story. If you like Alice in Wonderland and that sorts of like nonsense, even the Tim Burton or any of it, any of the different remakes, the filmic remakes, I think that you would enjoy the story. Especially good to support POC authors.
Support them all. Before we end, it's time for real talk. Did reading this book make your perspective change in any way, or did it make you interrogate a concept slash system slash trend you hadn't before? Kelly?
This one quote stuck out to me and that made me go on this like transcendental philosophic like tangent. So when Alice is using her nerd knowledge of fantasy stories to come up with a plan and like figure out where the eye is and where the heart is, she says this, quote, "All powerful heirlooms didn't just disappear. In every book she'd ever read, every video game she'd ever played, every movie, TV show, and anime, magical shit went missing but turned up eventually. The One Ring, the Deathly Hallows, the Triforce, this stuff didn't just drop off the edge of the world." And that's on page 217. And it just sent me down this, like, spiraling into this kind of nice line of thinking that narrative and stories, and especially science fiction and fantasy, they have this unique capacity to make humans imagine other ways of being that I think can be profoundly liberating and that could actually be a tool in, you know, when we're doing like praxis of trying to change this world into a more equitable and just place.
That's a great way to look at it. I didn't think about that. Do you know what Triforce is?
No.
Okay, me either.
Should I?
I don't know. I didn't look it up. I was like, it's probably a Star Wars thing.
No, so, I don't think it is.
Oh. I don't know what it is.
I stan sci-fi and fantasy.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. And watch out for the occasional minisode about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Do you know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on the podcast app of your choice. Literally, we're on the Fi. We're on Spotify now.
We're everywhere.
If you have a few minutes, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show because it helps other people find us. JK It's Magic is recorded on land traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native peoples. Until next time, stay magical.
Oh, I don't have a thing.
I know.
Is that okay? Okay. No, I was just making
I was trying to be like, and we're done.
Okay. I was just making sure. I was like, I don't have a thing. I know all these black stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I got it. I get it.
And you're like, good. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's good. I'm so glad.
No.
Okay.